from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
We are living through the most dangerous challenge to the free government of the United States in decades.
That's how senior editor for The Atlantic and George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum characterizes the threat posed by Donald Trump's presidency, which Frum says will corrode public integrity, the rule of law, and democratic norms around the world. We'll talk to Frum about what he sees as the president's authoritarianism and the duty of the people to resist it. Forum is next, after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We're going to talk in this hour with The Atlantic's senior editor David Frum, but first we want to get an update on the Oroville Dam crisis with KQED science editor Craig Miller. Craig, we're hearing, well, let me welcome you first, Craig, and say good morning to you.
Good morning, Michael.
I want to make sure I have you online. We're hearing about evacuations, damage to the spillway. What's the latest news on the dam?
Well, this morning they're beginning a rather daring operation of trying to stabilize the hillside that was eroding so badly that it triggered this crisis in the first place. This is the bare earth hillside that on the other side of the lake from the emergency spillway. That is unlined, unlike the concrete's main spillway, which is like a big water slide that goes down to the river. And that, as soon as water started pouring over that, that hillside started eroding rapidly. I was there on Saturday, and it was a pretty sizable mud flow taking trees into the Feather River, pretty much taking everything with it as it went down that hillside. But later it started cutting back, creating a deep groove that looked like it was backing up toward the underside of that concrete lip, which is the top of the spillway. And if that was undermined or undercut, that could easily trigger a catastrophic flooding event. So this morning they're going to go in there and try by using helicopters to hoist large sacks of rocks and fly them over the site and start dropping those rocks into the crevices. They call it caulking. The engineers in the trade do, to try to stabilize that hillside, because it's possible that they're going to have to use it again.
Are they also talking about taking out about 50 feet of water?
Yes. At the same time, they're draining the reservoir as rapidly as possible by using the main spillway, the one they can still control. It's damaged but still functioning. And they're putting 100,000 cubic feet per second of water down that slide into the Feather River. But it's like trying to drain the bathtub with the faucet still running, because there's, of course, still water coming into the lake from seasonal runoff. The good news is they say that there's more water going out than coming in. The level is dropping, but they have to get it down about 50 feet to the point where it's no longer putting pressure on the lip of that damaged emergency spillway.
And there's still fear about that 30-foot well of water.
That's right. The emergency spillway is very different from the main spillway. The main spillway is a narrow opening with a gate that can control the flow. The emergency spillway is really just a big notch in the rim of the lake with this concrete lip across it. And it's 1,700 feet long. So there's a lot of water coming over that. If that were to collapse, because it's about 30 feet or 40 feet high at the high end and tapers off at the other end, if that were to collapse or be undermined, you could conceivably have, you know, a 30-foot sort of wall of water coming straight off the lake and into the river, which would be pretty devastating downstream.
And you have about a couple hundred thousand people who have been evacuated. Better safe than sorry is what was essentially heralded about this on Friday, because there was real fear then that this would fall within an hour. And people are essentially being advised not to travel north toward Oroville or Yuba and Butte counties, Marysville as well. Don't travel toward Oroville, period. Just wondering, though, on Friday, Governor Brown asked a Federal Emergency Management Agency to declare the area a major disaster due to the flooding. So where does that stand, do you know?
Yes, and they've also done something else that's extremely rare. There's been a statewide alert of the National Guard in case they're needed. The number of evacuees is actually closer to about 200,000 at this point. And the problem is, of course, that that's a semi-rural part of the state up there, and it's not designed to move that many people all at once. It was pretty much chaos yesterday trying to get all those people out of there. All of the roads were jammed. Today we have multiple road closures in and out of that area and on Route 70 near Marysville, for example. So somebody, and I'm afraid the somebody is Corey Honey, the sheriff of Butte County, is going to have to make a very tough call today, and that is, do we keep all these people evacuated wherever it is they were able to go, or do we reverse the evacuation and let them back in? That's going to be a very tough call. How long can you keep people evacuated from their homes and businesses? You have to weigh that versus the risk that still very much exists, because until they relieve the pressure off the backside of that concrete lip of the emergency spillway, they're not really going to be able to breathe.
Craig, thank you so much for updating us. We will, of course, continue to be on top of this story, and I appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Michael.
It's Craig Miller, who is science editor for KQED, and I'm going to talk with David Frum now. David Frum actually has a cover story in the March issue of The Atlantic. He's senior editor of The Atlantic, and in this cover story, he imagines an America under President Donald Trump 4 years from now, when protests have foundered, the media have allied with the president, and a weary public is growing indifferent to the loss of individual liberties. Frum says that all of this and worse could come to pass unless people exercise their duty to resist President Trump's authoritarian and wealth-seeking tendencies. He was a speechwriter, that is, David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2002, and he joins us to talk about the vulnerabilities of our democratic institutions under the current administration and what we can do to protect them. And we welcome David Frum to the Forum program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
I guess before we go into your cover story, which I really want our listeners to be apprised of and know some of the content of and hope that they will read, I want to talk with you about Michael Flynn, because you've written about him, and this is a headline story now. And there's some sense that maybe his job is on the line here. What we're talking about, of course, are his discussing U.S. sanctions against Russia with Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the United States, before President Trump actually took office. And according to The Washington Post and nine former and current U.S. officials, this has been confirmed. It seems that he either lied to Vice President Pence or perhaps forgot what he had said. Is he going to have to go, you think?
Well, that will depend on this one question. Was General Flynn freelancing, or was he acting at the direction of the president? If he was acting at the direction of the president, it would seem difficult to fire him for doing what the president told him to do.
At this point, we just don't know.
And we don't know that. As I say, it's completely possible that, Flynn was freelancing. But let's have the larger context here, which is what they were what they seem to have been talking about, at least that's what these nine officials told The Washington Post, was the removal of the sanctions that President Obama had imposed on Russia for interfering in the 2016 election. So the incoming national security advisor, a man who has his job in part because the Russians interfered with our election, is telling the Russians, at a moment when the Russians are considering how to respond to those sanctions, don't worry, we plan to take the sanctions off when we come into power. Don't do anything hasty that will or might make our job more difficult. Now, that may be Flynn acting solely on his own initiative, but if the president communicated to him that he should do some or all of this, I don't know how the president fires him, especially when you remember that Michael Flynn's is not a fall-on-his-sword kind of guy. The reason he's with Trump is because he's so enraged at President Obama for firing him from the Defense Intelligence Agency back during the Obama administration. That sent him spiraling into a very lonely direction that ended up with Donald Trump. It's not clear that he would be a lot more loyal to Donald Trump if Donald Trump fired him for doing what Donald Trump possibly told him to do.
Well, over the weekend, Stephen Miller, security advisor to President Trump, said he was asked directly if President Trump had confidence in National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who may have been doing a kind of foreign policy operation on his own. And there was no response to that. And by the way, Stuart Miller was...
If Flynn stays, you know that the president very likely did direct that he have these contacts. Yeah. I don't imagine that the president explicitly told him, oh, and by the way, if the vice president asks you about it, lie to him. He may have wanted him to be more artful in avoiding the question than actually to lie outright. But if he's not fired, you have to presume that the president approved of what he did. And why wouldn't the president approve of what he did? Because after all, the president is the main beneficiary.
Miller also, by the way, said that they're going to rewrite the executive order. And he's also saying essentially that fraud undermined Trump's performance in the November election. I'm mentioning these two things because the reality of the article that you present in The Atlantic suggests that eventually you can erode public trust and you can erode civil liberties and people will just take things for granted. And you can perhaps also continue with what may be lying and delusional, and people will see it as normalization too?
Well, when I wrote this article on Trump's trend drive toward a more authoritarian style of government, what I wanted to do – I mean, there's a lot of talk about this these days, but a lot of it rests on big things that might or might not happen. You'll imagine another big terrorist attack. You imagine some other kind of dramatic event. I wanted to imagine – what if none of those dramatic events happen? What can you do without overtly challenging the constitutional system of the United States, without fighting the courts or defying Congress or giving the military illegal orders, without doing any of those things? How could you step by step erode the democratic system in the United States? And it's not such a crazy hypothetical question because we live in an age of democratic decline all over the world. Since 2005, the number of democracies worldwide has contracted, and standards of governance, even in societies that remain democratic, like some of the EU countries, Hungary, for example, Slovakia, Poland, we have seen those decline. So I imagine the United States walking a path not toward – this is not about some, you know, those lurid dictatorships of the middle of the 20th century. This is the path that has been walked by Hungary, that is being walked by Poland, toward retaining the formalities of democracy while corroding the substance from within.
And at this point, especially when you look at the cover of The Atlantic, you see Donald Trump, the back of Donald Trump, and literally thousands of masses of people just looking at him with his control, in many respects, as many see it, of hordes of people, masses of people, and their thought through Twitter, we're in a whole new ballgame here as far as possible autocracy, are we not?
The most important thing he has is control over his party in Congress. I mean, every day, Donald Trump and the people around him do a small illegal thing. Some days they do a big illegal thing. Most days they do a small illegal thing. You know, Kellyanne Conway endorsing Ivanka Trump's products from the White House briefing room. It's not the worst thing ever done in the history of the United States by any means. But it is against the rules. So something has to happen. Nothing happens. Donald Trump.
Well, she was counseled, they told us, right? That was their response. Counseled. She was counseled. Yeah, that word kept coming up, in fact.
Yeah. Donald Trump taking the Prime Minister of Japan to his own private lodging, and then we will never know exactly who paid for what. Did the Japanese government pay Donald Trump's family for the use of the hotel? Did Donald Trump, he says he made a gift of it. Did he make a gift for absolutely everybody in the Japanese delegation? Did anybody there buy a milkshake and pay for it with Japanese government funds? Those things would all be elite, but every day one of those things happens, and they're increasingly hidden. The premise of my story is that Donald Trump is not setting out to build an authoritarian regime. He's setting out to enrich himself. His challenge is that the things he wants to do to enrich himself violate either the rules of the United States government or even the laws of the United States. And in order to protect himself from some of those consequences, he must every day shut down a little bit one or another of the institutions that safeguards public integrity in the United States, including the congressional oversight process. And that is happening. And we are seeing his extraordinary control over Congress, that Congress is looking the other way. They are the main check on the presidency. The courts are the check of last resort. Congress is the check of first resort.
Congress could, of course, for example, pass a law that the president or anybody who runs for the presidency has to reveal their tax returns. But the reality is it's unlikely to happen for the reasons you suggest. There's a great deal of support and fear of Trump in this Congress. And also, when you're talking about autocracy, and there's a great deal of concern even now about checks and balances. When a president of the United States comes out and criticizes the judiciary the way he did during the campaign and the way he's done now in the face of the decision on the travel ban, I mean, Neil Gorsuch said, you know, you condemn one of us wearing a robe, you condemn all of us wearing a robe. And even that statement was pretty much elided over. So we're seeing an erosion here. There's very little doubt in most people's minds that that erosion is taking place.
I think the judiciary is probably the most robust of the institutions of the United States and the hardest for a president to tamper with. There are about 900 Article III judges in the United States at the Supreme Court, Court of Appeal, and district court levels. There are about 100 vacancies, but all of those vacancies have to be filled by people confirmed by the Senate, and all of those people are people who had their legal education at least a decade ago, often more than that. So the president has to deal with the legal system as it is. But what he can do is stay out of court and deal with institutions that are weaker. Congress, weaker. The federal civil service, weaker. The president has enormous power, and the Congress is talking about giving him more to remake the civil service. Right now, people in the civil service have some job protections. One of the high priorities of this Congress is to weaken job protections for federal employees. Well, when we hear about that employee at the Environmental Protection Agency who spent 6 hours a day watching pornography on government computers and nobody could fire him, we understand why you'd be tempted to do that. But the same law that protects that errant EPA employee is also protecting the CIA from being purged of those of its employees who know more or know embarrassingly much or are feared to know embarrassingly much about connections between Russian intelligence and our last election. Those are the places where the strike will occur. And one other pressure point, and I go into some detail about this because I think people have an old-fashioned idea of how this works, is pressure on the media. So long as when you hear the word media, you think of the New York Times and the CBS Evening News and magazines like The Atlantic, you're carrying in your head an out-of-date idea. The most important media institution in the United States is Facebook, and it is highly susceptible to political pressure.
And there was an article I should mention yesterday's New York Times about the fear that many civil servants are experiencing or anxiety about the Trump administration. I'm also inclined to ask you, since you wrote about it, about resistance or demonstrations. You have a great deal to say on that score as well. You talk about when you were in London and when you were part of the Bush administration and very modest in your appropriation of your own role in that, but there seemed to be some targeting of you. And now when the women went out in March the way they did, you said cathartic and self-expression, but it's not necessarily going to get anything done. And you kind of list at least a number of ways that something could be done and real pressure could be brought on the Trump administration. And let's talk about those. For example, first of all, you say get rid of the guys with the crowbars that are dressed in black because they're the ones who get all the media attention.
Right. So I end the article in The Atlantic by saying what happens next is up to you. The predictions I'm here giving, remember in Charles Dickens's Christmas Carol, Scrooge asks the last ghost, are you a vision of what will be or what may be? The ghost doesn't answer the question, but I'm here to answer the question. I'm showing you a vision of what may be, not what will be. What happens next is up to you. Public opinion came in a lot to say. In a subsequent article, I wrote about, I'm a person of the right, I'm not a person of the liberal left, but observing these demonstrations that are originating mostly on the liberal left, why they have not been more effective. I don't want to diminish what big marches can do. We are seeing how they are convulsing Romania. Right now, the Romanian government is trying to get rid of anti-kleptocratic laws. They are doing some of the Trump-like things there. They have hundreds of thousands of people in the streets in Bucharest, and it's making a real difference night after night. But that's at a crisis point. What you need to do first, to protect your democratic institutions, you need my bottom line is meetings are more important than protests. Protests are cathartic. Protests get people to introduce each other, but you need a program of action, and you need intelligent protests when you do it.
Now, forgive me. You used the dichotomy of the Occupy movement, which was protest, and the Tea Party, which was meetings. I think that's a fairly good bifurcation.
I've never understood this. I mean, so these guys with the black masks and the crowbar show up. There are a lot of them, but we're talking about a few dozen. There are hundreds of thousands of people at something like at the event. Sit on them. Call the cops. Take off their masks. The crowbar guys are a bigger threat to the people doing the legitimate protest. They think they're bringing down the state. They're not bringing down the state. The state has you can smash a lot of windows at Starbucks before you bring Lenin to power in the United States. You know, like an a million of them. But they are a threat and embarrassment to the people whose march they are hijacking. So cooperate with the cops. One of the things that I think, and one of the changes that the Trump presidency may do to our politics, and may do especially to liberal politics, is Trump benefited from the help of the intelligence services of a hostile foreign government, Russia. Someone like me can now looks to those people in Clinton world and Obama world and say, now do you understand why we told you you need a CIA? Now do you see why you need the National Security Agency and what counterintelligence is for? And now that you have this president who is following so closely the foreign policy line of a hostile foreign power, why do you surrender to him the false pretense of patriotism? Donald Trump should not be wearing a flag lapel pin, or at least not an American flag lapel pin. Take back. The symbols of the republic are your symbols. Cherish them and protect them. Carry the flag. Sing the anthem.
You've said, in fact,
you see somebody carrying a Mexican flag at your rally, tell them to knock it off and put it away. Carry that. If you're protesting Trump in Mexico City, by all means carry a Mexican flag. You're protesting him in the United States, you carry an American flag. That flag belongs to you.
You said put women police and women military, if you're going to have a women's march, women office holders, not necessarily Angela Davis as speakers and so forth. But does this explain pretty much why you, a man describes himself as a man of the right, has become such an outspoken critic of Donald Trump?
You know, I agree with Donald Trump on some of the things that Donald Trump claims he wants to do. And I remain a pretty conservative person on a lot of the classic Republican agenda. I'd like to say, you know, get low capital gains taxes, that kind of thing, deregulation. I'm for all of that. But the commitment that we share, or I hope we share, is to the rules of the American constitutional system. You know, we had Barack Obama was president for 8 years. I didn't agree with Barack Obama on very much. But I felt completely free to express my opposition to him in any way that I wanted. I believe, you know, I operated. I had never any thought that there would be any, so long as I obeyed the law, any improper consequence of my saying the president's wrong about this, the president's wrong about that. Organizing, I was at liberty. And under George W. Bush, maybe some people thought so differently at the time, but they were wrong. They were – the people who opposed his policies were at liberty. And they, you know, they sent him eventually a Congress that had a different view, and they defeated the Republicans in 2008, and the system worked. My rights protected today, your rights protected the day before that. My first attachment is to that system, the rules of the game more than the outcome of the game. And what I say to a lot of people who have liked the work that I've been doing, like the articles, like the Twitter feed, I want to be clear to them what we're working to jointly together for, I hope, is the day we can go back to whacking each other over the head about the capital gains tax.
David Frum, let me jump in here because we are coming up on a break, and I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation and direct questions or comments to you. In fact, you can do that now toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number to call, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. It's again 866-733-6786 to join us with senior editor of The Atlantic and former speechwriter for George W. Bush, David Frum, whose article, How to Build an Autocracy, is the March cover story of The Atlantic online. And you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Twitter handle is @kqedforum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In the March issue of The Atlantic, senior editor David Frum imagines an America under President Donald Trump 4 years from now, when protests have foundered, the media have allied with the president, and a weary public has grown indifferent to the loss of individual liberties. Frum says that all of this and worse could come to pass unless people exercise their duty to resist and President Trump's authoritarian tendencies. We're speaking to him, and by the way, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush, talking about the vulnerabilities of our democracy under the current administration and what can be done to protect it. We do invite your involvement in the program. If you'd like to join us, you can do so by phone at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org, or by going online to kqed.org/forum or tweeting us at our Twitter handle, which is @kqedforum. I'm going to go to your emails and postings in just a moment here, as well as your calls. There's a couple of things I want to touch on quickly with you, David Frum. I can't resist since Justin Trudeau has just landed in the United States and you're a Canadian. Any expectations of what might come out of this meeting?
I presume that what Justin Trudeau is there to do is to try to fight back against the protectionist pressures that are emanating from the Trump administration, not only formal protectionism by trying to rewrite NAFTA. And NAFTA, there are things in NAFTA that could be not modernized. That treaty was written before the advent of the internet. It doesn't cover some important things. But even more sinister, one of Donald Trump's big ideas is to use corporate tax reform as a way of writing protectionism into the tax law of the United States, and thus making it difficult for the world free trade system to continue. And this goes to one of the core thing. After his threat to the constitutional system, my second core worry about Donald Trump. Americans have built, the world has built, this amazing Western security architecture, of which NATO is the most visible expression, that rests on our global free trade system. It's one of the most important achievements and contributions toward peace and prosperity around the world that the United States has built since the end of World War II. And it is now, that too is now in danger. And the relationship with Canada, I mean, messing up relationships with Canada and Australia is a hard thing for an American president to do. Those relationships are set at excellent, and it's very hard to budge them below excellent, but that's what Donald Trump is trying to do.
And let me just ask you about a question that's come in from one of our listeners, Jeffrey, who wants to know if you read Andrew Sullivan's piece, The Madness of King Donald, in New York Magazine, which I happened to read. I don't know if you did, but Jeffrey writes, how do we handle the fact that the president is so divorced from reality and the truth? What Sullivan argues, just for the sake of listeners, is that Donald Trump may be living delusionally. In fact, recently Al Franken, senator from Minnesota, said that some other GOP senators, which he didn't name, and he agreed that we may have a president who has serious mental health difficulties and is delusional. And this is on a lot of people's minds. You don't necessarily like to go into speculation along those lines, but here it's Andrew Sullivan and people like Franken who are doing it.
Yeah. It's an interesting article. I recommend people read it and pay attention to it. I have to say, I don't take a view. I mean, I make one of my rules not to go inside the box of Donald Trump's head. People ask me questions like, why is he so pro-Russia? I mean, we can all speculate. I don't know. But what I can see is what he does. People say, why does he tell so many untruths? I don't know, but I can see the consequences of the untruths. I think we have to deal with the actions. Not that these questions are uninteresting or unimportant, I'm going to leave them a little bit to the biographers. As we try to stormproof the American constitutional system from Donald Trump, the question of why he is doing things is not the most immediately important. The most immediately important is to make sure that we stand up for truthful communication and against lies, to make sure that the government is run properly. People need to pay attention to this astonishing security breach that happened at Mar-a-Lago just yesterday when he was meeting with when he met with the Japanese prime minister and they got word of the North Korean missile test. And the president, I mean, it's hard to call him that, but he is the president of the United States, was on the terrace at Mar-a-Lago reading top secret documents in front of the other paying customers and illuminating those top secret documents with flashlights from people's iPhones. As the New York Times report aptly said, an iPhone is a mobile satellite TV broadcast unit. And if there's any kind of Russian or anybody else, Chinese or anybody's device on that iPhone, that as these top secret documents are illuminated, they could also be being in effect faxed to some foreign intelligence operation in Moscow, in Beijing, who knows where.
Let me go to our callers. We begin, Chris, with you. Join us. You're on the air. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm an attorney here in California, and I feel like we didn't see much of Stephen Miller on the campaign trail, at least in some of the liberal public circles. But seeing him on the interviews yesterday seemed to have revealed a potential source of some concerning public policy positions inside the Trump administration. And I'm curious if Mr. Frum has seen him before, is aware of his positions, and is this somebody new as we have whittled down through the foot soldiers in the public sphere of the Trump administration? It seems like we're finally getting to some of the real roots of some of the problematic policies.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Chris. Stephen Miller seems to be rising in power, doesn't he, David Frum?
I know Stephen Miller. I knew him when he was on Jeff Sessions' staff in the Senate. I know Steve Bannon. Weirdly enough, I have a cameo in one of his movies. What I would urge everyone to keep in mind, though, you know that old saying about if only the Tsar knew what the Cossacks were doing? The Cossacks work for the Tsar. And I'm sure there will be staff changes. I don't think people should get so invested or excited about White House staff that they lose sight of what is the source and direction, the impetus of all of these policies. White Houses often include people with unusual views, less than perfectly adapted personalities. The White House system is meant to mobilize those people's strengths for the president and put, some odd characters to good use. But if you have a president who shouldn't be there, and if you have a White House staff system that is broken down, if you have a weak chief of staff, if you have a compromised national security advisor, then the characters of these mid-level staff people, even if they have some good ideas, it becomes very hard to put them to good ends.
Let me thank Chris for his call. We'll go right to another call, and that's you, Rod. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about the guys in the black masks and the crowbars. I was the only moderate Republican in Eldridge Cleaver's class back in the early 70s at Berkeley. And I watched the idiots who were breaking windows and acting out and thinking they were going to bring down the government virtually guarantee Ronald Reagan's election, which was the last thing that they wanted to have happen. I think that the people who have questions about the Trump presidency need to focus on simple ideas. Unfortunately, the American public right now, the voting public, is maybe not quite as well educated as one might want. I think it's important that everybody should have the right to vote, but I think we have to be very careful to keep the conversations at the level that everybody's going to grasp. And your speaker, who I'm really impressed with, but when you use words like kleptocracy, you leave about half of the room scratching their heads. You want to talk about anti-corruption measures, everybody gets it. But I think we all need to be very careful to keep the conversation focused and at a level that everyone will understand.
All right, Rod. Well, I thank you for that call. I don't know if kleptocracy is a word that's obscure, but the reality of what Rod said initially, I think, bears some focus, David. In your article, you say single demands are more apt with marches and demonstrations to create success, and you also talk about the importance of building allies.
Right. Look, the most effective mass mobilization movement of my lifetime was Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Transformed American culture. And they had one demand, tougher punishments for people who drive drunk. They didn't care what you thought about guns. They didn't care what you thought about abortion. They didn't care what you thought about taxes. They didn't care what you thought about immigration. Anyway, so long as you agreed that there should be tougher penalties for drunk driving, come on aboard. And the United States passed those laws, and the result is that fatalities on the highway have been radically brought down. It's an amazing, amazing achievement. So when I look at the Women's March on Washington, when they said, we don't want pro-life women on the platform, what they are saying when they do that is, as opposed as we are to Donald Trump, that remains a secondary issue. This other thing remains our primary loyalty. And I think that understates, in my opinion, the urgency of the situation. I would advise those who want to stormproof the American system to focus on two demands, and only two. And the two I would recommend are, number one, you mentioned earlier, a law requiring the Secretary of the Treasury to release the tax returns of any major party candidate for president and the sitting president and vice president. They'd be welcome to do it voluntarily, of course, but if they don't, that the Secretary of Treasury would release them. And second, an independent investigation with subpoena power of Russian activity in the 2016 election, headed by respected people of both parties and with an executive director with an intelligence background. You focus on those two things, you'll do a lot of good. And whatever your view on any other question, if people are willing to work on those two things, they should happily work together. And let us hope that there is a long, long life of constitutional republicanism ahead of us where we can disagree about all the other issues in a free country.
And here's another caller, Colin, joining us. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Krasny. So I have basically a comment and essentially two questions, fairly quick, actually, though, for Mr. Frum. So first of all, I was at Berkeley. I was trying to rescue another person who was getting beaten. I had bones broken. I'm probably going to have some facial scarring. So I want to ask if Mr. Frum will stand with me there unarmed, trying to disarm protesters, or if he's just going to stand back and do that because he thinks it's apparently so easy to stand against armed protesters when you don't have anything. Second question, of course, is I'm glad. I just want to see if this is an endorsement for starting to roll back the imperial presidency that, you know, that his Bush administration managed to pass and, of course, prospered under President Obama and led to, you know, a record number of prosecutions under the 1917 Espionage Act. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. David Frum.
Let me take the second part first. I think, on the contrary, the Trump presidency is proving why we need effective counterintelligence services. Why those intelligence measures and those intelligence agencies are so vitally necessary. After 9/11, the laws were toughened. The Patriot Act had a five-year—I thought this was a piece of statesmanship. It had a five-year sunset clause. Congress expires automatically. Congress acts to extend it. And President Obama did make some changes to President Bush's policies. As the caller said, by and large, he adopted them, which I think indicates, and this is the leading critic of the Bush administration, but he thought, you know, in retrospect, I mean, obviously he never became a supporter of the war in Iraq, but he thought he had his criticisms, but he thought that the things that were done after 9/11 were basically sound, subject to some revisions that he made. I am not a skeptic of those things. I think we need a strong presidency. We need a strong, honest, and loyal presidency. As to the first point, congratulations to the caller for standing up. As you alluded to in that article I read about protests, I was not the victim of violence, thankfully, but I have been in crowds with large hostile situations. And one of the things that I have found from those experiences, and there have been more than one, I mentioned one, is if you talk reasonably to people, most of them will behave reasonably back. And if there's an outlier and someone who does want to be obnoxious or even worse, be violent, that you'll find you have a lot – if you're in the crowd and you're behaving in a responsible way, you will have a lot of allies. And there will be a lot more of people who basically want to do the right thing than there are people who want to do the wrong thing.
Let me read a question from a listener named Steve who says, an article in The Observer says that American intelligence services are starting to withhold information from the Trump White House for fear of their incompetence and Russian connections. If true, this already sounds like a serious crisis. Can Mr. Frum shed any light on this?
I know that article is written by a man named John Schindler, who is an alumnus of the National Security Agency and knows a lot about the intelligence matter. I don't have the competence or knowledge to evaluate whether he's correct or not in what he says. Look, we're in a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. Obviously, it would be shocking and frightening if elements of the government were withholding information from the elected president because they didn't trust him as a security risk. That's a terrible and dangerous, dangerous situation. And it's a dangerous situation if you have a president who can't be trusted. I don't know that it's actually what is happening. John Schindler is certainly better positioned to know than I. And I don't know that I have a ready answer as to what the right thing for those professionals to do. We have a very serious situation, and both paths are fraught with really sinister possibilities.
There's another question that you may not necessarily know the answer to. Gary writes, are there any indications that Trump supporters are beginning to understand and acknowledge the clear danger we are now facing? It's a tough thing to measure, and it's pretty early on still, but it would be fascinating to know the answer to that. Let me read a comment, though, from Andrew, who says, as much as I appreciate David Frum's feelings on the matter, I feel a certain sense of schadenfreude. So few conservative voices were a check and balance to the outrageous statements and lies from the likes of Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and Alex Jones. You reap what you sow, and Donald Trump was elected because of decades of conservative silence to the lies of liars.
I don't think it's a very helpful way to think, frankly. And I don't think I'm not a giant fan of Rush Limbaugh's. I don't think it makes sense to equate him to Alex Jones. And I also think one of the things that if we rise to the test ahead, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to understand which actions by people we strongly disagree with are nonetheless legitimate forms of participation in the American political system, little as we like what we're saying, and which things are outside the bounds of the American political system. And I think what I would urge that emailer to say is that Rush Limbaugh, little as you like him, he's operating within the rules, and his listeners are part of the American political conversation, and he's not a foreign agent. Alex Jones, and although Rush Limbaugh does inflame and does distort and does sometimes appeal to people's baser instincts. He doesn't flat out lie in the way that an Alex Jones does, and he doesn't tell people not to have their children inoculated against measles. And we need a sense. We need to overcome the narcissism of our own politics and to understand. And the way I put this on the right, that I, one of the things I thought that as that buildup came, that I often get this, you know, why, you know, you didn't get as upset when Barack Obama extended the power of the presidency to do things that we as conservatives don't like. And I said, well, Barack Obama did a lot of things that I didn't like. And I thought some of the things he did, especially with his executive orders on immigration, he did exceed the powers of the presidency. And the courts told him so. And he backed away. He followed the rules. And so I can disagree with Barack Obama pretty intensely and yet recognize him as somebody who's operating within the American – by the norms of the American political system. And that's the attitude I would recommend to that writer. And if you want to – the more you want to say that Donald Trump is a normal – is just an expression of Republicanism as usual, however emotionally gratifying you find that, the more you are actually helping and supporting him as he does what he does, which is not Republicanism as usual.
I think that also brings up a distinction that some make between Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence. Mike Pence has, of course, been anathema to many on the left, liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call them, his stand on reproductive rights for women and his ideological evangelical Christianity and so forth. But the reality is that there's a kind of transparency and predictability in all that, which there is not in Donald Trump.
We all have, one of the things I say to my liberal friends, and my advice is you have to be less fussy. And if Donald Trump were to decide that he wanted to return to his first love, reality television, and were to resign tomorrow, and Mike Pence were to become president, liberals would hate what Mike Pence wanted to do, but he would be a normal Republican president. And then you should, I would say, against a Mike Pence, you don't belong to go to the streets. If you disagree with what he's doing, you know, sign, give, you know, $200 to the members of Congress and, you know, go knock on doors and go elect somebody you like better. But understand that Mike Pence will not interfere with your ability to defeat Mike Pence in a way that Donald Trump will interfere with your ability to check and defeat Donald Trump. They're different. And that's a great question, and that's such an important point. I think that's – if there's any silver lining to this so dangerous experience is if it helps us to reattach ourselves to our American institutions and understand what's the game, what's not the game. Who's sort of a normal figure that you don't like and oppose, and who's not a normal figure? Bill Maher, I was on his show just before the election, and he said, and you know, he's a fierce, fierce combatant, but he said he now feels like he called wolf a little too often about people like George W. Bush. And he regrets it because there were things he said about George W. Bush that he would have liked to have reserved for a real emergency like the one we face now.
Well, I'm going to go to more of your calls in just a moment. Let me just get a response from you, David Frum, from a listener comment. This listener writes, Frum is wrong to minimize the importance of spokespeople for the Trump administration. They attack rational discourse, talk over questions, bully with disinformation. Just today, NPR's Morning Edition had to fact check during an interview since it had become impossible to have an honest discussion with Trump's people. This has made critical analysis impossible.
Oh, yeah, I don't disagree with a comma of that. I think that person is exactly right. One of the things I talk about in the article is filling the air with lies, because when you do that, what you're trying to do is teach people not to care about anything. You're trying to make them cynical and disengage from the political process. So I don't disagree at all with the point about the significance of what is said. I was responding, and maybe I responded poorly to a question I didn't understand. What I was trying to say is, if you think that the world will be significantly different if Kellyanne Conway is replaced by the next Kellyanne Conway, it won't. Because there is, unfortunately, a large and even worse, growing supply of people willing to do Donald Trump's bidding. But this is a problem that emanates from the top of the White House, and staff resignations will not help. And staff ideology is not – the ideology of individual members of Trump's staff is not what explains what is going on in the Trump administration.
Well, at least in the next Kellyanne Conway may not chill for Ivanka Trump's what she's manufacturing or putting out into Nordstrom's. But let me get some more callers on here. John, you're on.
Hey, I just think it's really important to note, first off, we should all remember, listen to this, who exactly you're speaking here. You're speaking to David Frum. You're speaking to a former speechwriter for the George W. Bush administration during the first period of his term. in which distortions and all kinds of issues and deviations from what we would consider to be a quote-unquote political norm were also a regularity. Trump is not an anomaly. Trump is the product of decades of political malfeasance that has led up to the current moment. This is a whole Pandora's box of problems that are open. The Republican Party bears particular responsibility, but the Democratic Party has certainly not been innocent in this regard. And hearing this man on the air, literally going on and telling people who are doing what they think is right by protesting as through a variety of tactics, an extremely oppressive situation and governmental problem that we have now, and encouraging them to literally attack each other. These are divisive tactics that are being used by a neoconservative on the right, a long-proven neoconservative, right-winger, Republican speechwriter for George W. Bush. I really encourage people to think about where this is coming from and remember that the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend.
Hi, John, let me jump in and get a response from David Frum.
Yeah, John's exactly right. That's my background. That's my biography, and those are my beliefs. And I'm here to tell you that you're in a dangerous situation. And what I would say is that the only people who want more than people like John to convince you that Donald Trump is the logical continuation of Ronald Reagan and Dwight Eisenhower and George W. Bush are the Trump people themselves. They want you to believe that too. They want, above all, the Republicans to believe it too, because the moment large numbers of Republicans begin to say, you know what, Donald Trump is different, Donald Trump's ability to do what he wants to do will be severely impaired. So, John, congratulations. I do notice there's a certain mind on the left that says, I don't like Trump, but what I really hate is hearing Donald Trump criticized.
Oh.
And I see many of those, because that empowers, you know, right, because the people who most dislike Donald Trump are exactly those who want to uphold the traditional national security policy of the United States. It's because I want to uphold NATO and the Western Alliance and global free trade that I'm so concerned about him, and because I want to uphold the American institutions that we've inherited from Republican and Democratic presidents alike. If you are a radical who rejects that whole tradition, you may well say that Donald Trump is no different from all of those others. But I would say when you do that, in my opinion, you are enabling him. You are repeating exactly what he would wish you to say.
Well, let me thank John for the call, but I want to go to a tweet here and get your response to this listener. It says, you're saying Obama didn't break any rules. What rules has Trump broken?
Obama did break rules. I think he extended executive power too far when he had his executive amnesty of illegal aliens taking over a congressional power to write the immigration and naturalization laws, and the court slapped him down. And presidents, you know, push their powers. That was probably the most egregious case in Barack Obama's case. But as an 8-year opponent of Barack Obama, do I think of him as basically a legal person who worked within norms and tried to build consensus and obeyed the laws and followed? I do think that, yes. I pay him that tribute across the partisan dividing line.
Here's Bertha, next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My comment and question is, after years of right-wing radio and people like Rush Limbaugh, I do put him in the same category as – I disagree with your guest. I do put him in the same category as Alex Jones and Steve Bannon in many ways. After years of that, which has built a population who believes in false facts –
you know, Alex Jones says that that what happened in Sandy Hook was all a conspiracy to take guns away. I mean, you never hear that kind of extreme sort of thing from – it's just a total fabrication and conspiratorial. I don't think you hear that from Limbaugh.
I just want to interrupt, Bertha. Bertha, I wrote a Newsweek cover story in 2009, back when there was a Newsweek, about how dangerous Rush Limbaugh was to my kind of conservative politics. I can dislike things while also maintaining distinctions between those things I dislike and things I dislike more.
Yeah, well, Bertha had a question. Okay. I'm sorry, Bertha.
Yes. So my question is, we listened throughout the campaign ad nauseum to stories about Benghazi and stories about Hillary Clinton's server. Now we have huge issues like Donald Trump's business conflicts, that our election was very probably hacked by a hostile foreign nation. And the FBI seems not to be doing anything. The Democrats seem to have no power, and the media seems complicit, although I was so encouraged this morning to hear the fact-checking on NPR. My question for Mr. Frum is, what mechanism can call this back into some degree of normalcy?
Yeah, David Frum.
Well, that's the conclusion of the print article I wrote and most of what and the article I posted on protest. An aroused public opinion that presses members of Congress. Congress is where this will be most resisted, and Congress's passivity. The caller's right. Bertha's right about this. The Congress has been passive. Democrats are powerless, and Republicans are complicit. Change that. Republicans will change when they begin to get scared, and Democrats will change when they begin to feel empowered.
You mean scared of something other than Donald Trump?
Scared of losing their seats. So be an active citizen. And I think what's happening at these town halls, I find a tremendously encouraging event. This is politics happening. And one of the lines I say in the article about protest is meetings are what make democracy go. Meetings can be tedious. Protests are fun, but protests are valuable to the extent they motivate people to attend the meetings.
And let me mention again that the link to the article, actually mentioned for the first time, the link to the article in The Atlantic is on our website. David Frum, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your being with us this hour on Forum. David Frum, senior editor of The Atlantic, former speechwriter for George W. Bush. For all of us here at KQED, stay tuned. George Saunders is next. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.